This is The Guardian.
Während ich mit dir rede, erfasst die Apple Watch mein Lauftraining in der Trainings-App. Ein Sensor checkt, wie schnell mein Herz schlägt. Algorithmen berechnen, wie viele Kalorien ich verbrenne. Und ein GPS pingt Satelliten an, um meine Strecke zu verfolgen. Ich muss einfach nur laufen. Apple Watch. Die Zukunft der Gesundheit am Handgelenk. Erfordert ein iPhone 6S oder neuer.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's set out some ground rules. Panelists must look at me when I'm talking to you, look at me when I shake your hands at the end, and really look at me if I'm talking to you and shaking your hands. Good. Manchester United, at bottom of the Premier League, hammered by Brentford. Is this the nadir? Can it get worse? Is the worst part that it wasn't that surprising? And what on earth can Erik Ten Hag do to make them better? Meanwhile, Chelsea absolutely batter Spurs 2-2. Harry Kane scoring in injury time with his first meaningful touch. How exciting for Tottenham to have someone who can beat the first man from a corner. All while Conte and Tuchel get alpha on the touchline. Men being men in front of men, pulling each other's hair. It's what proper football men want. Also today, Arsenal are good, Gabriel Jesus is too. Manchester City bans sun cream, Gerrard beats Lampard, Brighton can't score goals again, and on a very good weekend for Dean Henderson, Declan Rice is sorry. All that, plus a goalkeeper scoring for QPR, box set recommendations, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max. I am pretty confident I'm going to have dissolved into a puddle by the end of this podcast. I'm just sitting here pouring with sweat, and it's very unpleasant.
You just moved to Australia. It's freezing.
You lucky bastard.
Paul McInnes, hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello. Hello.
Hello, Barney Ronay.
Hi, Max. Hi, everyone.
Peter, does anyone on the panel know how many seasons of the Premier League there's been? No, none of us have any idea what the answer to that is. But let's start with Brentford 4, Manchester United 0. Michael says, is it time not to treat a Manchester United defeat, poor performance as the norm and not the lead story from a weekend? Jamie says, despite Jordan saying on the last pod we shouldn't be surprised anymore when United lose, are we allowed to be surprised when they're losing 4-0 to Brentford before half time? And Jamie says, I know you'll have a lengthy slot for giving Brentford credit on a famous win. I really must insist, once you've dealt with my club, if you'd find 30 seconds to ponder why Manchester United was so bad and what this means for Ten Hag. I know it is customary to start to say, before we talk about X, let's give credit to Y, when X is the big club who lost and Y is the small club who won. But I think we should probably start with Manchester United. Seventh successive away defeat, worst away run since 1936 from Wilson's column. Their starting 11 cost eight times more than Brentford's. That was a bleak day, Barry, wasn't it?
Yeah, for Manchester United and their fans. I think it was highly amusing and entertaining day for everyone else. I thought it was fantastic. We all know Manchester United are a mess. They're a mess. Their owners are venal, greedy, and not investing money in the club, despite the fact that they're spending money. There's an important distinction to be made there, I think. Do we focus on them? Do we focus on the players on the pitch, all of whom are supposed to be very good footballers, but who played like a pub team on that? In that first half, or for most of the game, to be honest. I think Brentford went quite easy on them. I was pretty confident before the game that Brentford would win because they are a better team. Not necessarily with better players, but they are a better team. They have a better, well, on the evidence I've seen so far, a better manager. But it was shocking to see just how pathetic Manchester United were and to see them 4-0 down after 35 minutes.
Paul, were you shocked at David De Gea for the first two goals?
I thought the first one was... I don't even see how that can... it's just one of those ones where you've seen that sort of thing many times before. But the ball was just not going with enough velocity to sort of even make it complicated. I haven't watched it super, super close up to see if there was a tiny little nick that it bounced off, but it didn't look that way. It was a massive aberration, and I don't think kind of fronting up to it afterwards really makes that much of a difference. And when you do that as a keeper, obviously any confidence you have in the team, which seems to be pretty low, is probably going to evaporate, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Dee says, well, David De Gea on the first Brentford goal, blinded by the bright lights of West London that were meant to blind Ben Mee. We'll get on to Ben Mee a bit later. Dee says, is there time for Manchester United to look into this Dean Henderson lad before the transfer window closes? And actually, Barney, Jonathan Wilson's written about De Gea. For once, he's not written that much about Ronaldo, saying, look, you can't, if you want to play out, you can't have him. He's really good at saving shots. Man United concede a lot of shots, but you can't have him if you want to take those kind of goal kicks.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that people have said for a while. I mean, Ten Hag has directly addressed that and said he doesn't agree. I mean, you always have to remember that managers, they're managers because they are experts and they spend a lot of time with the players. And if he believes that's possible and that De Gea can do that, he must have reasons for believing that. But I know, I make no apologies for feasting on the bones of Manchester United. We have to enjoy this while it's here. And it's kind of in a sweet spot. It's like that point where you're three quarters of the way down a tube of Pringles. And you think, hang on, I'm just going to keep eating this. I'm going to push through because I know I'm going to feel terrible in a bit. I know this is bad for me, but I just love the dust and the salt and the whole filthy, delicious taste of it. It's just fascinating. I mean, we want to do this and that everybody has an idea. Everyone has a solution. I heard one pundit on the radio saying the problem is that Erik ten Hag needs to grow a pear. That's the problem. He hasn't grown a pear. I don't know what that would solve. But I think it's also, but I think it's quite an important point because what he did, what he's done with his team so far is actually very brave to play Christian Eriksen in strange, innovative positions, to try to assert his kind of methods and what he wants to do. It's actually very bold. I mean, that's bravery. It just hasn't worked. I also heard that every single Manchester United player is a bad character. Every single member of the squad is rotten. It's a rotten squad. They're all bad people. That what's happened is they've recruited 100% cowardly, venal, rotten players, which, if that were true, is actually an amazing achievement. We always say we want like a coherent recruitment strategy. You need a philosophy. Everyone needs to be on the same page. And maybe that is, but why doesn't that work? Well, if everyone is, every single one of these players is a coward and selfish, then maybe that should actually work because it's completely joined up. It's the kind of thing Man City would do. There's no nice players in there. They're all evil. But obviously it's not true. And we've got into this situation where people say everything needs to go. We need to knock the stadium down. They need to knock the stadium down and cleanse the soil. It's like Chernobyl. You need to get in there and dig out this toxic, somewhere 50 metres under the ground, there's Alex Ferguson's shin bone, which is ruining everything. And it's just not true. That's not true either. Like, we'd like to talk about culture and philosophy and all this kind of stuff. Like, a philosophy is apparently a way of passing a football or a way of standing on a touchline or of shouting at people. It's just competence. They just have not very competent people running. Everything else about the club is fine. They make loads of money. They've got loads of fans. They've got a really big stadium. They're really close to being in the Champions League. If you introduced five competent people in the key positions in Man United, they'd start winning on the pitch within a year and everyone would stop going on about knocking down the stadium, about everyone in the squad being evil. Like they've been taken over by the Orcs or something, or, you know, It's kind of ridiculous. Like, football is quite a simple game. When you win, it's okay. Arsenal have started winning, so everything's okay. It's a question of competence and of better kind of control from the top. And things change very quickly. And then we wouldn't have to knock down Manchester and bomb Stratford and all the rest of it. I think it's a lot simpler than people think. But the results are hilarious, and we should all make no apologies for enjoying them.
So what are the five positions? They need a competent manager, right? A competent head of recruitment. What, a competent owner? And if it is simple, is it going to happen? Because it's unlikely to happen, isn't it? Because
no, it's not going to happen, but there's a paradox. Like, we're told that the owners are only interested in money, and all they care about is taking their dividends and using it as a cash-drenching machine. If that's true, and they really are ruthless, so businessmen, why aren't they interested in winning? Are you going to make more money if you appoint competent people? But then the theory against that is that they want people who will agree with the strategy and say, yes, okay, sign Cristiano Ronaldo because that's extremely good for the eyeballs and the general sort of vibe around the club, but it's not to make any tactical sense whatsoever. So that's fine. So you want people who will agree with your primarily commercial strategy in those positions, sort of yes men, effectively. So I think it's kind of a combination of incompetent grasp of what the sport involves at the very top, and a really commercially run operation where you're going to dip out eventually. You're going to say, that's it, I'm done. And for the Glazer family, this has been brilliant. It's not been a disaster at all. It's been really, really well run. The commercial arm's been fantastic. They've made money. They won't look back on their time at Man United and think that was terrible. They'll think that was really, really good for us.
Paul, what's a good season for Man United now? Is it too early to start going seventh? I mean, is that ridiculous? Because it is only two games. They have been pretty bad, but it is only two.
I mean, a good season for them would still be to qualify for the Champions League, and they've got enough good players to do that. That would seem, you know, it would seem particularly watching the Chelsea-Spurs game yesterday, you would think, well, they're quite a way away from hitting that level. But I would say they've still got a squad big enough, rich enough to do that. But I think really, realistically, what a successful season would be, to coin a phrase, you know, some kind of identity being clear on the pitch by the end of the season. You'd hope that's a, you know, there's a bit of that that's a style of play, but there's always been something about United, which is for the fans in the ground as much as anything, they connect with the players. And I think that is something to do with, you know, doing anything to win, that kind of Roy Keane kind of mentality, but also, you know, young players brought through the academy. And I kind of feel like it might be in somebody's interest at some point to put their hands up and go, okay, this hasn't been working. This strategy of just, you know, making sure that in every window we still buy a high quality brand name player to show that we've still got it has not been working. We need to change, and we're going to do this. And, you know, stop me if I'm wrong, but I think United have several young prospects at the minute that you could, like Fergie's fledgings back in, what was it, 95, 96, just dump them in the team, start playing with them. You know, accept you're not going to qualify for the Champions League, have some fun along the way and reveal that actually you're not as bad as everything looked out. I think expectations is as much of a problem as anything else.
I think the answer isn't holding money at big name players in a bid to paper over cracks. And I think the first solution that needs to be taken is that Cristiano Ronaldo needs to be drummed out of that club, sidelined, may train with the kids, bombed out. And I think that would be a start. But I can't see any immediate short-term fixes to the Manchester United problem, because their owners, for whatever reason, aren't interested in winning trophies. They're interested in qualifying for the Champions League. That, I think that's enough for them. And we do see, like, Tampa Bay Buccaneers, when they won the Super Bowl, Joel Grazer was front and center, accepting the trophy, as happens in the Super Bowl in American sports. The owner receives the trophy rather than the captain or the manager. I suspect, in the very unlikely event that Manchester United win a trophy this season, he won't be anywhere to be seen. And that kind of shows how interested he is in the football aspect of things.
David says, was Ronaldo sending a message to the manager of, this is how little I'm going to press, by starting the game in a long sleeve shirt in 30 degree heat? Look, Brentford scored more goals against United in this game than they have in every game since World War II. I mean, I don't know how many, they may have only played them a couple of times, so who knows. But first victory against them since 1938. Brentford were really quite good in this game, weren't they? And we should address that at some point in this podcast.
Yeah, they were outstanding. Look, Brentford are a well-run club with a good owner, a progressive manager who has a strict no-dickheads policy. That seems to work for them. On the pitch, they were outstanding. Matthias Jensen, I thought, was brilliant. Ivan Toney bullied Lisandro Martinez, as I suggested he might on Thursday's pod. They played an incredibly energetic pressing game that Manchester United had no answers for in incredibly oppressive heat. And I think it's important we remember that, how hard they worked in unbelievably hot conditions. I know they're, you know, elite athletes who've had a pre-season, but as we saw from Manchester United, it's very easy not to bother trying too hard if the conditions don't suit. And they forced Manchester United into errors, and I was slightly disappointed they took their foot off the gas in the second half, but it's completely understandable. But they as a club, they seem to be everything Manchester United are not. Nice, shiny new stadium, you know, good owner who supports his manager, good recruitment policy, and not particularly massive name players, but a group of players who work hard for each other.
And that fourth goal, Paul, was stunning, wasn't it? I mean, the pass from Tony was so good.
Absolutely stunning. It's just one of those ones, because it's not even particularly aesthetically, it's not like there's a trick in there or anything. You know, it starts with a big hoof, but the hoof is so, like, considered and played blind and exactly where Tony needs it. And then that, you know, to play that's an Eriksen-style ball coming from a striker who's known for his kind of physical threat right across the box. And then Bueno as well, you know, just the coolness of it as well. You know, because by that point in time, you've got enough seconds to consider what you're actually going to have to do and potentially freeze on it. He didn't, and he just calmly sold the keeper, slotted it home. And I think, you know, I think Barry's right there about Jensen, the game he had, you know, just in every, again, for a player who's not, he's considered utility, you know, gets about, does a bit of everything, but everything, all the aspects of his game were exceptional on the day. And that is not taking somebody who's born with God-given talent or God-tier talent. Is taking somebody who's willing and capable and coaching them and having a response, you know, that allows them to develop and get to that level.
Our very own Robin Cowan, BBC might own her more than we do, says, has anyone checked on Ben Mee, given our discussion of whether Ben Mee would be the bright lights of London, might lead him astray? Peter sent a tweet saying, Ben Mee out in the big city tonight, heaven protect him, with a man gurning wildly in a nightclub. But it was lovely to see him scoring a goal. United go to Liverpool next Monday at Old Trafford. Barney, what is good? What's good for United in that game? Like, what possible result? Would they take a 2-0 defeat?
I mean, maybe, but they've done okay occasionally against, actually not in the last two seasons, but recently. I don't know. I mean, Liverpool are an interesting place as well. They're going to play tonight. And I'm interested to see if they have the physical force that they've had in previous seasons without Sadio Mane and everybody's a bit older. I do wonder if something might have dipped in the level of physicality that team has. And again, I think it's details. I do think Man United's season could turn quickly, or at least, you know, they're not as bad as they looked. You know, that they can't go there thinking a 2-0 defeat would be a good thing, although it may actually be a good thing.
I was just thinking, if I was a Manchester United fan, I'd just want to see a competent performance by players who are really trying. I worry that they might not get that, and that would be a source of huge concern for me. We need to remember, this time last season, or more or less this time last season, Arsenal had lost 3 in a row. We were all laughing at them and saying they were doomed and, you know, hadn't a hope. And they turned things around. They should have finished 4th. They blew it towards the end of the season. Bad start to the season, bad end. But United don't look like a team who are about to turn a corner. They look like they might get worse,
which would be funny, let's face it. Let's end part one there and start part two at Stamford Bridge.
Während ich mit dir rede, erfasst die Apple Watch mein Lauftraining in der Trainings-App. Ein Sensor checkt, wie schnell mein Herz schlägt. Algorithmen berechnen, wie viele Kalorien ich verbrenne. Und ein GPS pingt Satelliten an, um meine Strecke zu verfolgen. Ich muss einfach nur laufen. Apple Watch. Die Zukunft der Gesundheit am Handgelenk. Erfordert ein iPhone 6S oder neuer.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Chelsea 2, Spurs 2. Barney, you were there. This was really fun, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really fun. It was an amazing game, an amazing afternoon. It was, you know, we talk about how hot it was because everyone knows it was hot. But there's something about Stamford Bridge, is quite a close, ground. You feel very close to the pitch. It's very packed in. and everybody was just dripping with sweat. The whole thing was like a sensory overload. And we were right behind the manager's dugout there, so you got to see you got to see the several incidents of interaction between. I mean, it was so funny. There was one point where when Chelsea scored their second goal, Tuchel went off on his touchline sprint, and he was wearing very, very tight trousers, and he's got really long legs, and his arms are really long, and it was exactly like you know that scene in The Office. I think it's like The Office Party, or maybe when he's just thrown a shoe over the office, and Gareth comes steaming past with his arms and his legs pumped. It was like, and that's sort of a bit of a meme. It was exactly like there was a mate out the corner of your eye. You saw this ludicrous cartwheeling man. And we had a really good view of the handshake as well, which was very exciting. I think you need to know the pressure of the relative pressures. Somebody started that. Only people who were inside that handshake will ever know how that played out. But somebody started, somebody else responded, and then you got into the kind of Ring of Roses thing of spinning Antonio Conte around. That's just so. You don't do that. You don't spin. Nobody spins him around. You don't ruffle his hair. You don't spin him around. It was amazing. And I don't know, Premier League sometimes can be, you know, you find lots of reasons to feel morally compromised by it or to think, what are we doing? We take it too seriously. But that was just like pure entertainment, really high level football. And people like this total lose yourself in the occasion thing. And it was very sort of beautiful afternoon, and it felt quite redemptive and quite fun.
I'm absolutely convinced that Conte held the handshake and then made out that Tuchel had been holding him, and was like, this, I cannot believe you are doing this to me, while clenching the guy's fist, despite, you know, breaking his bones in the process.
Isn't the idea that, you know, it's taking on from Jamie Redknapp's, you know, look at me when I'm talking to you. That, you know, Conte went to shake hands but didn't really want to have a long chat with Tuchel. And Tuchel was obviously so furious that they just let in that goal, because they totally deserved to win that game, I thought, that he wanted to make a thing of it. So then he was like, well, I can say you need to look at me when you shake me in the hand, shake my hand. And actually, I don't know what you think, Barry. I sort of think you do need to look at someone when you're shaking their hand, don't you? I can't think of a moment when you shake someone's hand and you're not looking at them. There was one ex-footballer I won't name who did once shake my hand and not look at me, and I thought he was a massive bellend. So,
well, yeah, I think a handshake should be firm, but not too firm. And, yeah, you should look at whoever's hand you're shaking. But we do see a lot of these perfunctory token handshakes at the end of games, and generally managers don't really care about them. But, yeah, it's all good fun.
Yeah, actually, I was watching the international coverage, and Glenn Hoddle was on there. And actually, he was there with Zola, and they were both trying to claim their absolute bias for who was wrong in handshake gate. But he was saying him and Tony Pulis would have these massive rows over handshakes that would go down the tunnel. And now he's sort of older and going, what on earth was I thinking? It's just totally ridiculous. Chelsea, I thought, were brilliant in this game, Barney. I mean, they must be so... The Spurs goals, and we'll get into them, were slightly controversial, but Chelsea outplayed them for, what, 80 minutes of the 90?
Yeah, they were really good, and they shut down Spurs' attack really well. Reece James, Jorginho and Kante were all... Whoever was nearest to Kane, as soon as he got the ball, just bumped straight into him, shut him down. They stopped him from having any effect, really. And that changed when Conte obviously could see that happening and brought on Richarlison, and they played with the two. He told them to play very close together, and they did, and Kane was much higher up the pitch, so people weren't getting into his space, and that did change things, and they started having some chances and could have scored actually before then. But basically, I mean, Chelsea did dominate the game because their system worked, and they pressed really hard, and you realise that they're actually a... You know, Tuchel's a brilliant manager, and he's had time this summer to work with them. And probably writing them off was a bit premature. I thought Raheem Sterling was really good as well. He made lots of good runs, and he's just such a good signing. He's such a kind of... he's kind of unreliable in that he will miss chances like he did, but he always plays a certain level. He always keeps coming back. I think he's a brilliant Premier League player.
Yeah, I was slightly surprised, Paul, that lots of people were saying, well, Spurs are favourites for this game, given their record at Stamford Bridge is appalling. And given how good that Chelsea team are, you know, and their midfield, as Barney said, their midfield was much, much better than Tottenham's midfield.
Yeah, I mean, I credit Tuchel with a lot of that. I do think that he understood quite where he wanted to kind of set the traps to stop, you know, particularly any build-up. You know, there was no opportunity for the rapid counter for Spurs because, you know, effectively those the centre halves and Bentancur were just closed down. But I read one take before the game saying that, you know, Chelsea's midfield wasn't up to it because they were playing two defensive midfielders. You know, Jorginho and Kante, they didn't have the range, but obviously that is only true up to a point, because if you get them to kind of give the ball to people like Reece James, who can make things happen, then that works. And also the fact that they're a club that's sort of torn everything, you know, new ownership, torn everything up in the summer, and lots of new signings who haven't really had a chance to bed in. Plus the depletion of the defensive ranks. But I thought Cucurella had an incredible debut, you know, liability of his hair aside. I thought he looked really, you know, composed, strong, athletic, really calm, had slotted in straight away. And obviously Koulibaly, you know, incredible finish, which I think I've probably seen him do before for Napoli. But, you know, it looked like a world-class centre-half, and that's what you wanted from him. So those new signings bedded in quite quickly and obviously helped them. And Spurs looked a little bit stale, you know, I wasn't trying to think whether it was a bit Spursy not to show up on a game like this, but I decided it wasn't. It would be more Spursy to go 2-0 up and throw it away, perhaps. But they looked a bit stodgy until, I didn't think Richarlison played particularly well, but once they brought Richarlison on, the shape changed, things opened, and the game was much more competitive.
Lucas says, have you decided yet how you will pretend that the refereeing in the Chelsea-Spurs match was totally fine? An Arsenal fan, Lucas, writing that, Barry. Both Spurs goals were controversial. I guess Bentancur takes a bit of Havertz and maybe touches the ball about 25 minutes before the goal. That's my Spurs bias saying there. But Richarlison was in offside position. Then you've got Cucurella having his hair pulled by ultimate shithouse Christian Romero before the corner that Harry Kane scores from.
Well, I'm probably going to infuriate a lot of people. I thought the ref had a good game. He let it flow. There were tackles going in, and that helped the entertainment. There was the Bentancur foul on Havertz after losing the ball. I don't think there's any question it was a foul. And then it's how much of a gap was there between that and the ball going into the net. I found myself watching the highlights, having watched the game, using my stopwatch to time it. And then I was thinking, what are you doing? Like,
this is what football is for.
Is this what? Anyway, for the record, I think it was 44 seconds I made it. But between that foul and the ball going into the net, Kante, Cucurella twice, and Georgina all had blocks or touches on the ball. Now, there's the question of Richarlison standing in an offside position. Yes, he was. Was he in the goalkeeper's line of sight? Maybe. I don't know. I don't really care. And the hair pull on Match of the Day 2, interestingly, they pointed out it's not a foul. There's no law against pulling an opponent's hair. But it is violent conduct, so it should have been a red card. And then the corner should have been taken anyway. So Spurs would still have had the corner, but they'd have been down to 10 men.
Dave, is this hair pulling legal now? And if so, will there be a new bald premium on follically challenged players? Is the era of Cucurella, Guendouzi, Luiz and Fellaini over? Are we entering the Viali, Zidane, Fabinho and Robin dynasty? If you can get away with blatant... Yes? Sorry, Bunny.
Well, maybe it's like Adama Traore in his baby-oiled arms. If you have incredibly slick gel, yes. or the return of Brill Cream, try grabbing that. Yeah, and you'd be washing your hands for ages, this horrible, unpleasant feeling on you. Nobody wants an unpleasant feeling on their hands.
How much Brill Cream would Cucurella need? I mean, it's a lot of Brill Cream for that amount of hair, isn't it?
I would love it if Cucurella came out for Chelsea's next game with a shaved head, just for the giggles.
Do you know who Cucurella looks a bit like?
Who?
Well, if you were to take, say, like a frizzy Cucurella style wig and put it on the host of this podcast, what would that look like?
Do I look like Cucurella?
I think so, yeah.
Wow. You'll
take it, won't you? He's about half your age.
Well, I'll add it to the list. You know,
I mentally took the hair away, and I just saw a bit of Max Rushton there, I thought.
The list spans goes from, you know, Ben Affleck and Ryan Reynolds at one end to Screech from Saved by the Bell and a man slapping a bar stool at the other end. So I don't know where you put Cucurella in all of this. Just a word on those corners, though, Barney. I mean, I don't think I've seen a better left-footed in-swinging corner since Andy Hinchcliffe. And Perisic put in two. And I don't think Tottenham had anyone who could take corners for about 20 years.
Yeah, apart from Harry Kane, you know, he should have been on them. Yeah, yeah, they were really good. Yeah, I mean, it makes a huge difference. Premier League teams who have been good at set pieces, like West Ham last year, have tended to do very well in recent years. And it's kind of a non-Spursy thing, isn't it, to get those sort of bonus goals from just being good at a rehearsed move. That changed the kind of narrative. I suppose they did come back twice, despite playing badly, which is a very Conte thing.
Yeah, and he's got a long throw, Perisic. So I'm a big fan of long throws in the Premier League. Dan and Paul both got in touch specifically for you, Barney, on the subject of you know, Kulusevski is what the kids say to mean cool, but they wonder if you can confirm whether kids are now using Koulibaly as a rather than Kulusevski as a term of approval.
I'm not sure. Does it have the same kind of broski, kind of bro talk, kind of snap? I'm not sure. It sounds a little bit more. It's maybe a little bit more sort of the whole thing was terribly bally. It's more Bertie Wooster, isn't it? It's Bertie Wooster having Bertie Wooster has an. There's a famous scene where he has an existential crisis in one of the books, and he says, "You know, Jeeves, the thing that's so terribly bally is the whole of life just sometimes seems so bally." And that's the closest Woodhouse gets to sort of, you know, ruminating on the meaning of life. Maybe it's a little more like that.
That's where Koulibaly fits in the lexicon. Let's go to the Emirates. Arsenal 4, Leicester 2. Gabriel Jesus was brilliant in this game, Barry.
Yeah, and it speaks volumes for his performance that he scored twice, provided two assists, and was apparently devastated afterwards in the dressing room because he felt he should have scored four and probably should have had a first-half hat-trick, certainly, but... Arsenal fans, lots of optimism there, and I'm not unsurprised. He, I suspect, if he stays fit, will be an outstanding signing for them. And I think he's feeling a little bit more love there than he got at Manchester City. I'm not saying he wasn't appreciated by Pep or by Manchester City's fans, but he's clearly been told, "You will start. You are my main guy. Go out there and get us goals," and he delivered on. He possibly underachieved on Saturday, despite his excellent contribution.
That's his first goal, Paul. But technically, to get that sort of lift and curl when you're standing completely stationary is exceptional.
Yeah, I was watching it and just said to myself, "Sand wedge." I mean, I don't even understand golf. It just felt like you had to use a golf metaphor at that point, but just to get that loft. And you know, again, it's just a sign of confidence, isn't it? To be able to kind of have that in your inventory at that moment, your mental inventory, to go, okay, I'm going to pick that one and do that. Show somebody who's wanted, understood, and thinks, you know, has a role to play in the team. What I saw after the game was like people are now saying, "Oh, Odegaard's fallen off and Saka's fallen off," you know, because these guys, because all the goals were coming down the left hand side of the pitch, now the right side abysmal, which shows that kind of like, when you've been in the mud for as long as Arsenal have, it takes a long time to kind of actually start shedding all those doubts and self-loathing and actually kind of think, well, we've got quite a good team here.
But actually, Barry, you noticed, didn't you, when Saliba scored that quite spectacular own goal, like the Arsenal fans like applauded him, not for the goal, but to sort of gee him up, which probably wouldn't have happened to Granit Xhaka 3 years ago or no. To sort of any late stage Wenger team, would it?
No, there'd be a lot of faces contorted with rage and spittle-flecked swearing. I think Arsenal fans just realised they've got a little gem there. Well, a big gem. He's a very stylish centre-back. He looks like the real deal. And oh, these things happen. It was quite a spectacular finish by him, you have to say. If not at the right end of the pitch... But, they were eager that he didn't let his head drop, I guess, and wanted to let him know he was appreciated. Happy Arsenal fans. It's a rare sight. And, you know, I think I'd like to see more of it.
Paul?
I just wonder how you know, obviously Granit Xhaka scoring and then going off to celebrate, doing a little heart hand and stuff and looking absolutely buzzing. It must be such a weird journey to go on for him, you know. There was no greater pariah at one point, was there? And he's now gone on the journey from being somebody who was absolutely loathed by tens of thousands of people every week to somebody who can form a bond with these people now and kind of like feel part of them again. You must be very forgiving if you're Granit Xhaka, I reckon, because I'd probably hold it against people.
Are Arsenal good, Barney?
Yeah, I mean, they do seem to be, which is good. Because, you know, Arteta, I always felt, even when they weren't playing that well, that he'd achieved one important thing, which is to make them feel like they were bad in a different way. Like, there wasn't, it wasn't the ghost of Wenger kind of lurking. Nobody ever talks about him anymore. That, because he had such a clear way of how he wanted to play, and he was pretty ruthless with some of the players, he, whatever flaws the team have, its own flaws and his flaws. And that seemed like a really big achievement, even when they weren't that good. Although they still won, you know, the FA Cup. And he absolutely, I mean, I don't know if I'm a massive fan of his, but he's so into it. He's so obsessed. He's so obsessed with his coaching and with his with the life of the coach and with what he's doing, that it's impossible not to get slightly swept up by it and to feel that whatever he does, sometimes in football, just having a plan is enough of a plan, so long as we all agree it's the plan. And I feel that's kind of the case with him. If, as long as you follow what he wants to do and everyone agrees, then it will be a good plan. And the team do have a way of playing, and I think that their Premier League games will be their biggest games of the season. And I wouldn't be surprised to see them do okay in the league and finish in the top four, because they should do. You know, the club has the money and the players to do that. And if everybody's playing the Arteta way, whatever that is, it doesn't matter, then I think that they'll have a good season.
Meanwhile, Leicester, Barry, are in a pickle. I mean, Rodgers was explaining after the game, they just don't have the money to buy anyone. I think they're as far as I can tell, they're something like the only team in the world, the only team on earth, not to have bought a player in this transfer window. They're going to have to sell before they buy. They're still letting goals from set pieces. It's a tricky spot for them.
Yeah, I don't particularly understand. They clearly have valuable assets who are wanted by other clubs. James Maddison, Wesley Fofana, Harvey Barnes are all wanted and would cost a lot of money. So they could presumably bring in players on the strength of selling one, two, or all three of those players, but they'd be big players to lose. And the longer the window goes on, the more the Leicester premium will increase, because players will know, or other clubs will know, they're a bit desperate. They've had to do a bit of a rebuild before, after winning the title. Brendan Rodgers doesn't look like he's thrilled to be there at the moment, and maybe his tenure has run his course. He might fancy a change of scenery. I'm not sure, but they weren't terrible in this game, but yeah, they're in a bit of limbo at the moment with regard to who will still be there at the end of the month.
Alrighty, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin at the Etihad. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Man City 4, Bournemouth 0. Look, since every City performance now, Barney, must be judged solely through the orbit of Erling Haaland. He only had 8 touches. He made just 2 passes during the 74 minutes he was on the pitch. One was a kickoff, one was an assist. But it doesn't really matter, does it?
Yeah, he helped create a goal, and that was good play. And the kind of good play he'll have to do more often. I was talking to someone yesterday who suggested that there's going to be two types of games for Haaland this year. There's going to be the one where he has to play two totally different ways. The one where City have all the possession and it's all about finding a moment and just using a moment to contribute. And then games where City gets space, where other teams have the ball, where he's absolutely devastating, because if you're breaking with the ball and there's any kind of space behind, he's unstoppable with players who can pass like that. So this was one of game A, where he just has to contribute in some way. And it was interesting that there were a couple of occasions where I thought the opposition were so sort of spooked by his presence that there was space for other players. Like, you're always aware of where Haaland is because he's this terrifying presence. He's kind of, it's like having like the nuclear deterrent. You know, it's like Putin having nuclear weapons. It's, what do? We need to tread incredibly carefully around this team, because they have this vast, terrifying weapon that can destroy us. And I'm sure that he will lead to other players weirdly having overlaps in other spaces, rather than being a sort of an extra body. He's a kind of extra vibe. He's a terrifying sort of presence that puts teams off, because you have to watch him at all times. And I think he'll have a few games where he's not touching the ball much, but oh, he's just happens to have scored or made a goal. I wouldn't be too worried about his touches. Everyone else has enough touches to make up for it. It looks like City will work out how to make this thing work, which isn't surprising because everyone involved is incredibly talented.
Barry, yes, you, 2 weeks into the season now, have you come to terms with how big Erling Haaland is or not?
Well, there was one stage someone played a long pass towards him. He got in, well, hadn't quite got in behind, but Jefferson Lerma went to try and shoulder him off the ball and just bounced off him. It was quite comical. And to be fair, he should have scored, because there was an opportunity quite early doors when Phil Foden should have squared the ball to him and he had a tap in, but Foden elected to shoot, which infuriated Haaland. He did the classic hands out in front of him, why didn't you roll it my way? But you know, even without doing much, he did a lot.
Paul, Kevin De Bruyne's finish was so lovely. I'm trying to think if there's a nicer type of goal than an outside of the boot into the corner finish.
I mean, it's just imperious technique, isn't it? And I thought he had a great game. And you know, the reminder, as Barney's saying, that you know, if Haaland starts acting as a magnet to other players, then you've got players who are just as good as him who can take advantage of that. And he ran the game. I was wondering a little bit about what Bournemouth might take from this match. You know, just a more of a generic question, really. What happens when you're a promoted side or a relegation candidate and you come up against this team? Is 4-0 against City where a decent return? I mean, they kind of
par. Do you reckon, is it par? Do you reckon that's about a par score?
I would say it probably is about a par. And but on the other hand, you know, a lot of the statistics, they actually kind of, you know, in terms of interceptions and blocks and passes, they did all right in the game. They only got one shot on goal, and their fullbacks were regularly rinsed for possession. I kind of feel like it's one of those ones there's not all you can do is really look at it and go, we weren't good enough. And will we ever come under that same amount of pressure again? It was difficult, I think, for a club like Bournemouth in that position.
Guardiola gave a debut to 17-year-old Rico Lewis late on. Born more than 5.5 years after Bournemouth last picked up a point against Manchester City on the 21st of November 2004, the day that Girls Aloud's I'll Stand By You took over from U2's Vertigo on the top of the charts. I don't know if any of you see Sun Cream Gate. A man called Elliot tweeted Manchester City to say, genuine question, can we bring sunscreen? I'm in the East Stand lower and the sun will be beating down. To which Manchester City Supporter Services said, hi Elliot, sun cream will not be permitted on entry into the stadium. We advise supporters apply this before coming in and to bring a hat and water. And Jamie did write to the pod to say, why are Man City banning supporters from bringing in sun cream? The whole of Manchester trades off the back of sunshine. It does, Barry, seem ridiculous, doesn't it? What can you do with sun cream?
Well, you can squirt it at rival fans. You can throw it at players. The bottle, I suppose. It's unhealthy. Of course, fans should be allowed to bring sun cream into the stadium. I would burn to a crisp if I went out in this heat without sun cream on my pasty Irish skin. But it speaks volumes for the behaviour of some supporters that they cannot be trusted to bring a bottle of sunscreen to a football match.
But say, bottle of Factor 50 is quite expensive. I mean, if you're going to lob that, it's not cheap sun cream, is it?
Well, we're talking about fans who literally throw money at, you know, rival fans and players.
It's true. Villa 2, Everton 1. First managerial meeting between Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard. What does this mean, Barney? That Gerrard is conclusively better than Lampard at managing football teams?
Yeah, it's funny how obsessed we still are with that sort of clash of personalities. When manager is quite a small part of the trajectory of both these teams. It's funny how Gerrard's stock has dipped and people are saying he was genuinely under pressure before this game. Whereas he had quite a promising start, I thought, and he's won trophies, and I actually have some optimism that he might be a good manager. I like his kind of very controlled, solid, quite negative style, which seems the exact opposite of his own kind of marauding playing style. I find that quite interesting. And I kind of assumed he might be the next England manager, because he would take that as a step up and it would kind of work, and he'd be the anti-Gareth because he's a kind of inspirational figure and all the rest of it. All that result really says is Everton, we're in for another sort of slightly hilarious Lampard-Everton season, where we seem to be a mixture of really sort of passive-aggressive statements of how bad his team is, as though it has absolutely nothing to do with him, and ludicrously unbound celebrations when they actually do well, when it suddenly is all to do with him. So that in itself, I welcome.
Paul, what have you made of Tyrone Mings gate?
I don't think it was well handled. I think even if it were the case that you were going to strip him of the captaincy and then give him a game to kind of cool off, it didn't read that way, which was sort of mismanaged by somebody, because it read like, I've actually decided that from being one of the most important players in the club, you're now absolutely not important at all and we can discard you, which it's going to be counterproductive for the squad in general. So I'm sure that isn't what he wanted to do. Mings played all right in this game, and certainly, put in a number of blocks. I think, I can't remember who it was at the end. Was it Gordon or maybe Onana that kept them in the game? Because actually the last 15, 20 minutes of the game were really exciting. Villa were lucky to win in the end, I think, despite having had the best of the first half. But it's just one of those things. You've got a player who is, he is loved by the fans. He is a symbol of the kind of Villa of the last few years. He's an England international with a massive social media profile as well. So you've got these further complications of how you manage that. I think Tyrone Mings has dealt with it perfectly well. He'll be expected to do his talking on the pitch, I guess.
To the City grounds, Nottingham Forest 1, West Ham 0. Forest first Premier League win in 23 years. West Ham possibly a bit unlucky. Mr. Penn hit the bar a couple of times. But great for Forest, Barry. And it's quite nice to see some new footballers who I was unaware of until yesterday.
Yeah, they rode their luck a bit. And maybe the gods were smiling on them. The first game at the City Ground in 23 years, a very special occasion. I understand they have a pre-match video they show at the ground, which is quite Clough-heavy, and they made some edits to that to add in, more recent great achievements from the playoff season. Had a look at that on Twitter. That was got the blood racing in me, and I've no.
Did you start sweating, Barry? No.
But it got the hairs up on the back of my neck. I've no particular affinity to Forest. They were impressive, because Steve Cooper has a big job in his hand, stating the obvious here, but brought in 13 players, has to assimilate them all in the squad, get them playing together, and they looked pretty good. As I say, a little bit lucky, but I don't think anyone would have begrudged them the points, apart from David Moyes, who felt the referee, without wanting to criticise the referee, made it quite clear he was criticising the referee, but in a way that won't earn him a fine.
True, he did, but I did feel for him, because the guy interviewing him, I think, on the BBC, he was just saying, you can't be happy with those decisions, and David Moyes went, I don't want to talk about referees. And he went, yeah, but, come on. And he went, no, but I really don't want to talk about them. He went, yeah, but come on, that's a bit frustrating. I mean, I would be annoyed. And eventually David Moyes was like, okay, yeah, I was annoyed by it. Paul, sorry, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, I just wanted to add just a little bit to the integration thing, which I thought was noticeable yesterday. They got 15 new players, but the ones who have come in straight away are those who have, a little bit of Premier League experience, but a lot of Championship experience. And O'Brien and Toffolo, I thought, played very well yesterday. The Huddersfield pair slotted in straight away. And maybe that's a way in which, if you've got a massive turnover, you start using the players who are more readily going to understand what's going on in the first instance and take longer with the more glamorous overseas signings.
Chad says, what's the earliest point of the season where players should take to social media to apologise to the fans for their performances? Declan Rice missed a penalty. He apologised to everyone. Barney, do you think that was the right thing for Declan to do?
No, I mean, probably, I don't think he needs to apologise, but thoughts obviously immediately turn to apologies talk about Man United again. So midway through the first half, I was immediately sort of separate. How's this going to play out? Who's going to apologise when? What's the tone going to be? I thought De Gea, you know, he was good. I mean, he was ready to apologise. That was someone who had an apology brewing in him. And that seemed to come very naturally. I think Declan Rice is kind of a pleaser, isn't he? He does a lot of sort of talking. He's very obliging. I think he could probably do with being a bit meaner and nastier, Declan Rice. He seems like a very nice person.
Baz?
I'm still waiting for him to apologise for declaring for England.
It's interesting about that penalty was that if it wasn't for that penalty that McKenna didn't get sent off because Dean Henderson was behind him, it was adjudged that he wasn't denying a clear goal-scoring opportunity. I would really say that is denying a clear goal-scoring opportunity, sticking your hand there when someone kicks it at the goal, sort of regardless of how many people are behind you. But anyway, it was only a
penny for the thoughts of Dean Henderson, actually, after seeing David De Gea's performance. Maybe he'd rather play for Forest, even if, had he stayed at United, he might get picked for the next game. Possibly. Do you want to be part of that shit show? I don't know.
Is that how Erik ten Hag sells it when he rings up Arnautovic? Do you want to be part of this shit show? Mark says, have any of the panel been approached with regards to signing for Nottingham Forest? Yeah, they really have signed a lot of people, haven't they? Neil Mopai looks to be on his way. A couple of others as well.
People are making a big deal out of this. They had to sign a lot of people because they didn't have enough players to contest the season. They have a squad to fill, and I believe they signed quite a lot of people last summer as well and the summer before.
It really is a lot, though. I mean, Man City have basically got 16 regular first-team players, and they've essentially signed almost the entirety of Man City's squad. And if you're signing these people, they're presumably going to be expecting to play. It is amazing. I mean, it seems part of the whole vibe is to sign loads of people and there's a lot of energy and it probably seems to sort of fit in with the way the manager wants them to play. But it is astonishing.
Three games to go, with apologies for not talking about them for that long. Southampton 2, Leeds 2. Paul, what did you make of this one?
I think it's interesting that Leeds have Rodrigo started the season well for Leeds, and I think that's good because they need goal scoring options that aren't Patrick Bamford. Particularly after losing Rafinha, I think the high energy is good, and you know, I think things are probably not as bad as feared for Leeds at this moment in time, but still, you shed a 2-goal lead, it's not a good look. And Saints will probably take consolation from that, even though they don't look like they got much about them at the minute.
Yeah, is it Sekou Mara whose assists for Kyle Walker-Peters? I thought that was superb, Baz.
Yeah, he looked, I think it was his debut. I must confess I've never heard of him before, but he impressed me. He brought a save out of Ilan Meslier. That assist was exquisite. I just don't know what to make of Ralph Hasenhüttl at all. But to his credit, the substitutions he made got Southampton back in it, and the Adam Armstrong and Joe Rebo combined to make it 2-1. So
yeah, two goalless draws then. Brighton 0, Newcastle 0. Brighton should have won this game, Barney. Are we allowed to say they just need someone to put the ball in the back of the net and then they'd be great?
Yeah, so I understand. But obviously, you know, they had a fairly easy start to the season and now they've finally come up against the level of quality they're going to face in this division. And, you know, that's a reality check after that stroll on the opening morning. It's not always going to be like that. This is a tough league, you know, Mr. Potter. I hope you're ready for it. So that would actually be good for them to face that level of opponent.
Nick Pope's clean sheet. He played really well in this game and, you know, they cleared a couple off the line. He became a Twitter sensation for reasons that I didn't know until producer Ian put them into the script regarding Burger King asking their followers for preferences of gherkins or tomatoes and the fan account Toonpole suggesting Nick Pope as an alternative. If a sort of unviable option, presumably after the first person has chosen Nick Pope in their Whopper, no one else can have him. Within hours he was trending and then it sort of took a life of its own that passed me by. But if you were part of that journey, good for you. And Newcastle, as
you use a slicer.
Yes, what was that?
You use a slicer like in a butcher's. So you just put Nick
on Nick
Pope.
Yeah,
put Nick Pope through the slicer. You can probably get a couple of thousand slices at least.
Guys, yes,
he's long, isn't he?
Yeah. That is true. I don't know if it would it add to the flavour.
No, but you only want a little bit. It's a sort of delicacy, isn't it?
That's true. Yeah, it's a delicacy. It's like, Nick Pope is a delicacy.
Truffle oil. If you put too much of Nick Pope in your food, it will overwhelm the flavours.
Truffle oil makes me gag. And as far as I know, and I don't know how close I've ever been to Nick Pope, he doesn't, but we'll find out.
I really hope you don't find out. Cannibalizing.
No, let me be clear. Even being, not eating truffle oil, but just being close, presence of truffle oil is a real... I had to ban a flatmate from eating it. Because it was
so if you ever do meet Nick Pope and he offers, to shake your hand, you probably won't look him in the eye while you're shaking his hand for fear
I'd be absolutely fucking terrified.
Vomit on his shoes.
Wolves nil, Fulham nil. Mitrovic missing a late penalty. So his season is over after that great performance against Liverpool. And we'll give Wolves and Fulham more coverage next time around.
Mitro, he misses quite a few penalties, I think. Didn't he miss a critical one for Serbia?
For Serbia, yeah. Oh, well, Joe Perry says, is Senny Dieng's goal for QPR confirmation that all short-sleeved-wearing goalkeepers are, in fact, centre-forwards with gloves on? Barry, were you disappointed to see Sunderland conceding a last-minute equaliser to a goalkeeper, or happy because it was a goalkeeper scoring a last-minute equaliser?
I was more amused than disappointed. I checked on live score on my phone at 5-5 or whatever, presuming Sunderland had held on, having been 2-0 up when I left the house with 5 minutes of the game to go, and was, oh, bugger. But upon discovering the QPR goalkeeper had scored the equaliser, you can't begrudge a goalkeeper a goal, even if it is against your team.
Gareth says, I watched the live gig. I noticed Barney is looking like he's been in the gym. How many Barrys could he bench press?
Well, I'd love to try, particularly a very sweaty Barry covered in suntan oil. Now you're talking.
That's something we'll perhaps do on the next live show, can't we? And Michael says, I've been reading Paul McInnes's Better Call Saul's weekly episode Guardian columns. I can't believe next week is the last ever episode. Which is better, Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad? No spoilers, please, because I haven't seen the last series of Better Call Saul, Paul.
I think it's still Breaking Bad, because without Breaking Bad you couldn't have Better Call Saul. It created something, and I think there's more memorable characters in the first one than the second one. But the second one does something different. It's a bit more low key, a bit more intricate. I mean, they're both absolutely brilliant, which is why I love writing about them every week.
I have never seen a minute of either. Does that make me a terrible person?
Absolutely not, Barry. You've got a very busy life with lots of other things going on.
Has he?
<Don't>.
Look, start Breaking Bad. I didn't finish Breaking Bad, and I did finish Better Call Saul, but I don't know what you think. I think there's a box set is as much about you and the place you are in your life as it is about the quality of the TV show. So you might, it's not defined by how good the show is. It's defined by where are you currently in your existence that means you've got five series or three series or whatever to watch.
Well, I most recently watched Ozark, which I think was about 60 episodes, and it was really good. I loved it. But once I was finished, I wanted something much lighter and frothier. So I ended up watching, I think, the first three series of the MacGyver reboot, which is, utter rubbish. But it was a nice palate cleanser. But I am in the market for something new now, so I might...
I've got a recommendation. I've got a recommendation. Only Murders in the Building. If you haven't seen Only Murders in the Building, it's on Disney. Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez doing this sort of... It's really an old-school 1980s... Steve Martin, Martin Short vibe, but set in the modern age about murders in a posh. It's got a murder mystery. It's incredibly intricate comedy. It just couldn't be better written comedy. And it's only 30 minutes long per episode. It's really involving. That's good. Recommend it to everybody.
I'm binging McDonald and Dodds on the recommendation of Jonathan Wilson. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. Barney, would you like to add to this? Or would you like to go home?
Well, I've just watched all of Stranger Things from series one through to the end, and surprised to find that it's absolutely brilliant. The style, it's like Twin Peaks with the aesthetic of The Ice Storm. I think it's really good. It's ludicrous. It makes no sense, but it's this contained world, which I always really like. If you can create that really coherent world, I find it good.
All right. Well, look, that's all for today. Since we've moved into the culture pod, which we may start again one day at the Guardian, probably not with us. Barry, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Paul.
As Harry Kane tweeted, spicy, love it. Proper battle to get a good pod.
Thank you, Barney.
Cheers. Thanks, everyone.
We'll be back on Wednesday.
This is The Guardian.
Während ich mit dir rede, erfasst die Apple Watch mein Lauftraining in der Trainings-App. Ein Sensor checkt, wie schnell mein Herz schlägt. Algorithmen berechnen, wie viele Kalorien ich verbrenne. Und ein GPS pingt Satelliten an, um meine Strecke zu verfolgen. Ich muss einfach nur laufen. Apple Watch. Die Zukunft der Gesundheit am Handgelenk. Erfordert ein iPhone 6S oder neuer.